So I'm curious to know if any of you had any lingering insights or thoughts regarding Tuesday's class, in particular, how we allocated the bonus points. If it's triggered anything for you where you're like, oh, that was interesting, or now that I've thought about it, I would have voted for a different option. Any thoughts or perspectives on that? Or did anything change after the fact, after you saw what your score was? Would that change how you approach the voting process or the decision-making process?
I never really had thought about the income redistribution part about it, even in the workplace, but it made a lot of sense after the points for the test and just like listening to all the different examples, especially with that owner of that one company who redistributed it.
The gravity company.
Yeah, it made a lot of sense.
Well, and for some of you, you did well on the exam, and the option that you voted for came at a cost to you. I mean, because the points add up over the entire semester, and so you, in a sense, voted not in your self-interest. Were you okay with that, or are you kicking yourself, saying, "Oh, I wish I would have had more information. Like, I wish I would have known what my score was before I jumped to vote." Yeah.
I mean, I think it was interesting. I think we would have had a very different turnout if, like, we had voted on it after we had seen our scores versus before. But, like, as someone who wasn't benefited as much, like, I feel like it's cool because I still got 100%. Like, I don't know. I feel like 100% is still pretty awesome. I don't know.
But a lot of, I mean, that's what a person could say if you're making $300,000 a year, and then it's like, well, what would you think about $350,000 or $400,000? You know, I agree with you completely. Like, to get 150 points, you really can't be complaining, but then why does it shift when it comes to income of, like, I have 150 points, but I want more. I need more. And after a certain point, there's a point of diminishing returns. But then you could also, on the flip side, say, well, the demand for that particular position is such that it warrants an excessive payment, but it escalates, and it escalates exponentially. And a lot of the research, especially on CEOs, but it trickles down. I mean, it happens in the university, like president salaries at universities are way offset, disproportionate to what the rest of the university population is making. And it's this sort of self-reinforcing thing. A lot with the CEOs is the board of directors sets their salary, but the board isn't just a random selection of people, it's part of that CEO's network of colleagues in many ways. And so they're going to, in a sense, pad each other's pockets and sort of give generous compensation. And even if the company isn't performing well, there's built-in incentive to continue to give the CEO bonuses because they don't want to send signals to the shareholders that things aren't looking good. So if they continue to boost the salaries of the CEO, that's a way to signal we're strong and we're doing well. And so there's a lot of complex factors that go into this. But you don't see many CEOs, like the one at Gravity, saying, hey, I have enough. I have enough money. I'm willing to take a pay cut. From my perspective, that takes a very bold and courageous move on the part of a CEO to step in and do that. And in many ways, You did this without knowing what your score was, but you probably had a sense of what your score was, maybe. And you demonstrated this posture of, I have enough, and if I can vote for an option that sort of benefits the collective or broadly benefits the class, then I'm willing to do that. There's a political philosopher, John Rawls, who basically looks at global systems and global development around the world. And so, you know, when the United Nations meets and they talk about how they're going to, the millennial goals, and now there's the new goals for 2030 of how do we help reduce inequality, how do we empower women, how do we improve education levels. And one of the biggest challenges with these big global policies, but it also translates down into organizations, is that people, what options they're going to vote for and what resources they're going to allocate is based on sort of what their social position is. And so if you're in the United States and you're thinking about global policy and redistributing resources, you're kind of less inclined to want to give to the poorer countries or adopt programs that are going to disproportionately benefit the poorer countries compared to the U.S. And with John Rawls, sort of hit one of his famous paradigms is this idea called the veil of ignorance, where the best way to make global policies or even company policies is to do it without having knowledge of your own social position. So in a sense, you would put everyone in the room, let's say you had the United Nations, but you wouldn't let them know what country they're representing. So they wouldn't know, they wouldn't sort of bias their decision based on what's going to favor them. And in many ways, that's what you did in class yesterday. You had a veil of ignorance where you really didn't know what your score was. And then I asked you to make a decision of which option would you pick. And in a sense, you picked the option that would most benefit the collective, even knowing that some people were going to be benefiting others at their own expense. And so in many ways, if you think of an organization, it's really hard to model this, but doing something similar where there's this veil of ignorance where you strip away, so how's this going to benefit me? And so a lot of this would be in human resource management, where when you think about evaluations and promotions, making it somewhat anonymous such that you're not saying, oh, okay, here's who I'm evaluating, or here's whose evaluation I'm reading, or here's who I'm thinking about for promotion. And you already have this grid of race and gender and age and all these things that are sort of filtering into your decision-making process. Whereas if you can sort of remove it, remove that information and just look purely at the performance, then you could probably make a better assessment. Or if you just looked at the spreadsheet of salaries and you saw discrepancies, and so you could look and say, okay, what are the things driving these discrepancies? So in some ways, this idea of the veil of ignorance is a way to approach decision-making where you can remove factors that the implicit bias or things that bias your decision. A lot of you, or some of you, made strong comments saying that this idea of redistributing equally, you were very opposed to. Like, it didn't sit well with you, especially with when you had a bonus. When I asked you to be the CEO of your company and I said, you can decide how you want to redistribute the bonus. And some of you said very emphatically that, no, you should be compensated in proportion to your performance. Versus, well, let's just be super egalitarian and let's give everyone an equal bonus. I agree with you. But I want to challenge the underlying premise. So the Equal Pay Act of 1963 was sort of put in place to sort of reverse these trends of unequal pay. So that was 50 years ago, basically two generations. And still, there's disparity, unequal pay in every industry except for a few outliers. But across the board, there's unequal pay for men and women. So if we use this performance paradigm, the other statistics that are out there is that women, on average, perform better than men in school. Women, on average, perform better than men with like standardized test scores. And so on sheer performance, there's a fairly good argument, at least in these arenas, that women are higher performing. And so then if you look at the marketplace or industry, and you see that across every industry, again, with the same job, same position, women are paid less than men across the board. The skewness of that statistic would suggest that something else is driving how salary decisions are made. It would actually suggest that performance isn't the factor being used. So I agree with you that people should be paid based on their performance, but I would say that the data suggests that they're not. Unless you are convinced that in all industries across the board that women systematically underperform men, and yet we know in school and in education and different activities that they outperform men. And so one way to think about this idea of, well, yeah, if I run my own business, it's going to be purely on performance. There's a lot of data out there that suggests that even for the people who try to do that, the numbers still get skewed in favor towards men, and it isn't based on performance. It's based more on structural inequality that exists. A lot of us were talking about how people negotiate their starting salary. If you also think about, you know, we look at the position of the person negotiating their salary, and if it's a male or female, but also you have to look at who's the person offering the position. And again, disproportionately, it's going to be a male offering the position. And so that alone sets up an unequal power dynamic, whereas if you had people in positions of power who are female offering the job, would that change the way that salaries are offered? So there's... It's easy to have a very simplified version of salaries are based on performance. But I would suggest that there's other social factors that are influencing salary apart from performance, and those are the things that need to be investigated and looked at. The question still remains that unequal pay exists, and so what are the recommendations for women to begin to reverse this? There's structural recommendations, but there's also recommendations for women. Sheryl Sandberg is the CEO of Facebook, and she wrote a very popular bestseller book called Lean In, which basically is her recommendation or advice to women and men in regards to women in the workplace and some of the challenges faced by women and some of the things that actually hinder them in the process. And I thought it's a very practical way of looking at the roles or the ways that women might approach the workplace or might approach activities at work that would inhibit their performance in the workplace. And we're going to look at a trailer from her book.
I entered the workforce believing that my generation was going to have equal responsibility and equal opportunity. And it didn't work out that way. Women are getting more college degrees, more graduate degrees, entering the workforce at every level. But in industry after industry, women are at 18, 15, 20% of the top jobs. Women are held back by many things. We're held back by bias, by lack of flexibility, by lack of opportunity. We also hold ourselves back. We don't sit at the table. We don't raise our hands. We don't let our voices be loud enough. I remember my first day at Facebook, driving to this new job and this hard job and not being sure I could do it. I think about all the moments when I just didn't believe in myself. Every test I was sure I was about to fail. Every job I wasn't sure I could do. I was after watching so many women quietly lean back, after watching myself quietly lean back and miss opportunities, that I started to see the pattern and started to talk about it. Why does this matter? Boy, it matters a lot. Because no one gets to the corner office by sitting on the side, not at the table. This book's for women of all ages. Young girls who are thinking about what their futures might be, people who might be out of the workforce thinking about coming back, or even someone who's a volunteer and wants to lean in and take on more leadership. To encourage women to really believe in themselves and believe in their dreams, and to help men do their part to form a more equal world by making sure that all of us have opportunities based on our passions and interests, not just based on our gender. Part of what I'm hoping Lean In will do is really start a conversation in every workplace, in every company, in every school, to start thinking about gender differently. I believe the world would be a better place if half our companies and half our countries were run by women and half our homes were run by men. This is about believing in yourself.
So this is an excellent book that begins to chart women not only in the workplace, but in society. And so the posture, the disposition that many of them might have, especially in the workplace or in decision-making arenas. And a lot of it is a way of engaging in the workplace, or even, I think, what Cheryl is talking about is having this sense of belief in yourself and in your knowledge and ideas and in your contribution to the organization. But I think that flips also for the men to recognize, you know, I play Ultimate Frisbee, and it's a co-ed team. And I notice that a lot of times it's skewed towards, I'm a handler, so I skew towards passing to the male players. And it's not intentional, but just sort of when I look back at who I'm sort of feeding the disc to and making the plays happen, it's biased towards men. And in many ways, I might be missing out on a unique strategy that could exist of recognizing that the women can play a role on the team where we could actually utilize them in a more strategic way versus the default play is, well, I just pass to the guys because that's what I'm used to doing, and they sort of have a way of getting open. But if I had a posture of thinking, okay, here's our composition of our team, and how could I optimize that for a more strategic, to be a more strategic, advantageous team? And I was thinking more and more about sports and how this relates to gender diversity. And we talk about in the book about glass ceilings. And what's interesting with glass ceilings, and I see this in the context of sports, and we talk about performance, and so we should hire people based on performance and who's the best performer. Why is it, let's say in the NBA, that there are no female referees? So there are female referees in the WNBA, there's female referees in collegiate basketball, but why not, you know, when you think of the glass ceiling, yes?
There actually are.
There's one. There's one now? Okay, good. So why is, when was the first one come out?
Recently, like last season, I think.
Okay. So why is it then that there is one female NBA referee? Is it because women just are not as good? They're low performing in the skills of being a referee? Yeah.
It could be a respect issue.
A respect issue?
Some of the players and coaches.
Uh-huh. So that they wouldn't be, their calls wouldn't be respected?
Or they wouldn't hold her, you know, credibility to as high of a standard.
Mm-hmm.
As maybe male refs.
Well, but a call is a call, right? And consistently, even if a male referee makes bad calls, they don't last very long. Or even if I'm a referee and I make a bad call, I can't bluff it and pretend like this is actually a good call because, I mean, you have everyone watching it and you'll be outed pretty quickly.
That is true, yeah. A call is a call.
Yeah. I mean, so I don't know if I see what you're saying, that the sort of initial perception is, can she really do this? But then, yeah, I mean, when you're performing on the court or on the field, you're either you make good calls or you don't. And we know pretty quickly when people don't make good calls. Any other ideas of why, again, if you have the paradigm that this should all be based on individual performance, which in many ways I would agree with you, if that's the case, then why would there be this glass ceiling that would suggest, that would say that women cannot perform at the level where they would be competitive refereeing for the NBA. Yeah.
I think it would take a lot as a woman to look at all the officials being male and saying, I want to go do that. So like maybe a lot of them would be turned away initially from even that, following that career path.
So they're not even sort of giving themselves the option of doing it. Yeah, I mean, a lot of it, if you grow up watching sports and you're a woman, and all you see is male referees, then you don't have a vision for, oh, I could see myself doing that. Olivia?
I also feel like women in sports that are televised are seen as sort of just like something to look at. Like the reporters are typically attractive women.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when guys are watching a sport, they like to have a woman report, but not necessarily be making the calls.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would agree with that, except for, and what you're saying is exactly right, but what's interesting, if you think about referees, they're kind of not noticed. And so I understand with like TV sports broadcasters, there's sort of a profile of who makes it into that. But with referees, you know, especially like, say, football, I mean, how often is the camera on the referee? Sometimes on the head referee, but beyond that, you're just kind of invisible. And oftentimes with most sports, the focus isn't on them. It's like your job is to call the play. And so it's a very task-focused thing, and you don't have much of a public presence. Your job is just to perform on the field. So again, it's just, for me, it highlights that even though we sort of have this posture of saying it's all based on performance, and whoever performs best gets the job, I would challenge that and say, no, there's other factors that influence who gets the job. And I think sports and refereeing is a clear example of that, but it also happens in other organizations. It isn't an anomaly to just sports. It's highlighted and magnified in sports, but it translates into other organizations. So we talk about glass ceilings, which basically limits women rising up in the ranks, because there are, it's not like there aren't women referees. It's not like there's just no one out there that we could hire. So, you know, how can you blame us for not having any? There are women referees out there, very good ones, but why aren't they being promoted? Why is there a glass ceiling? The other thing would be the glass doors. So glass ceiling is rising up within a particular field or industry. Glass doors are sort of transitioning into other industries or other fields that sort of where there's a barrier or a block. And the example that comes to mind for with this is with regard to football coaches. There is a women's football league. It's pretty small, and so the proportion, and there isn't much high school women's football, so the proportion of female football coaches is very limited. And in some ways, I would describe that as a glass door, where to even get into that industry, there's a barrier, there's something blocking you. And so then you would say, why is it, again, we're looking at performance as a coach, not performance, not physical performance, but strategy, team building, and recruiting. Why is it that in football, there aren't any female coaches in the NFL? There was one this summer. There was an intern at Arizona. She was the first female football coach. She actually was let go. I don't know. I don't know if it was just a short-term internship that she had, but so now there's no longer a female football coach. But if you think about it, again, why, if you want the best coach, why would you eliminate half the population? Why would you instantly assume that the female applicant or candidate couldn't do it? It just doesn't make sense. I mean, if we're talking strategy, women can have just as much strategic capacity as men. They can know the sport inside and out, know all the different the patterns and observations that they have. So there, again, I'm using the example of sports because it's something that we're all familiar with, and it helps to magnify the, I'll say, absurdity of the logic of thinking. Because we're thinking, we're asking about things like strategy, planning, team building, which are all things that you would do in an organization. You also do in leading a football team. And why is it that we have these barriers, that just these assumptions that, well, women can't do it? So there's a woman named Annie Duke. She's a professional poker player. And poker is another one of these fields that's overwhelmingly dominated by men. And she made it to the World Series of Poker. And World Series of Poker reduces it down to basically 10 players. And not only has a woman never won World Series of Poker, but women haven't even been competing in this final 10. So Annie Duke was the first female to compete in this World Series of Poker. And this was covered by ESPN. And what's interesting is what occurred for her at being at the World Series of Poker and all the pressure that she was feeling being the first woman in this arena. And she actually made it down to the last two people. It was her and another guy. And basically, she's at the table. There's $2 million on the table. And she has an opportunity not only to compete in the World Series, but actually to win the World Series, to be the first woman to win the World Series. And they did a clip on sort of what the gender dynamics were with the World Series of Poker. And we're going to look at some of the aspects of it.
It was 2004, and Annie Duke was about to win $2 million. Annie was the only woman in this competition. She'd knocked out eight guys, eight of the best players in the world, to get to this point.
But I didn't really feel like I deserved to be at that table.
Annie Duke's story is a perfect illustration of a very powerful idea in psychology called stereotype threat. It's an insidious thing, and here's how it works. Let's say you think people have a certain stereotype about you because of your gender, your race, your age, your sexuality. It could be anything. There's a part of you that's afraid that your actions will prove the stereotype is true. And because you're worried, you get distracted, and now the stereotype actually has a good chance of coming true.
I'm sort of thinking about, well, if I fold and I'm wrong, everybody's going to be like, see, she plays like a girl. Like, look how he pushed her around.
Annie Duke was pretty sure she'd been invited as the token woman. She felt that ESPN thought it was just good optics to have her at the table.
Despite the fact that I had spent the last 10 years making my living playing poker at the highest levels of the game, that I didn't really deserve to have ever won anything. I was bad, and I had just gotten lucky, and now everybody was going to know it, and what they were saying was true.
You felt like an imposter.
Completely. So that was in my head the whole time I was playing, and I'm not saying that I wasn't, as much as I could, making decisions that were separate and apart from that, but that discourse was kind of running in the back of my head the whole time.
So here's this woman at the World Series of Poker, gifted poker player, but what's going through her mind is a lot of questions that the other nine at the table either didn't feel at all or it was minimized. Because I think a lot of us all the time feel some level of being an imposter, like, oh, I don't deserve to be here. But it's magnified or amplified in this context where you're not only the only woman, you're the only woman ever to be in this situation. And when we talk about stereotype threat, her actions, everything that she does, is in a sense representative of all women. So if she blows it, it's clear that women can't play poker. Or if she makes a false move, or a misstep, or a bad decision, it reinforces all of these stereotypes. Or if she's over-aggressive or doing other things in a different way, anything she does is sort of being watched and labeled and characterized as this is representative of all women. Whereas the other nine guys there, what they do is kind of, people are just like, well, you know, bad move. You know, like, you lost. It isn't, look at men can't play poker. And so, again, I use this example because it can magnify what goes on at a micro level at work, of feelings of, do I deserve to be here? How are others perceiving me? What are the implications of the actions I make? If you're in this context, a male-dominated setting, your gender as a female becomes amplified. But it's true for any other majority or dominant setting where you're the minority. And oftentimes, again, if you're a male, white male in this room, this whole concept is just kind of foreign because we never feel it. But for someone who's a minority, things like this go through their mind and it plays with how they perform on the spot. And so this was very controversial. And in fact, she was sitting there thinking, oh my goodness, this is all a big hoax. Like, ESPN knew that by inviting me to play poker, it was going to raise their ratings because I was a woman, and now I'm going to blow it, and then it's just going to be a mockery to all women. And so she's like recounting all that, this is what was going on for her, and this is how she sort of explained some of her decisions. Actually, a lot of you probably don't know the outcome of this, so how many of you think that she won? Raise your hand if you think she won. Okay, raise your hand if you think she lost. Okay? So we looked at stereotype threat. I want to turn the table and look at a way to use stereotype, possibly, to your advantage. And what the commentator describes it as stereotype tax. It's sort of taxing people or taking advantage of people who have these sort of stereotypes of who you might be and how you might act and how you can actually use that to your advantage.
There was something else running through Annie's mind. She had started playing poker in 1994, and by the time she got to that championship game 10 years later, she had also figured out a way to make people pay, quite literally, for the stereotypes they had about her. In psychology, this idea is sometimes called stereotype tax. That's when a negative stereotype that others have about you works to your advantage.
I figured it was part of the game that if somebody was at the table who was so emotionally invested in the fact that I was a woman, that they could treat me that way, that probably that person wasn't going to make good decisions at the table against me. So I really tried to sort of separate that out and think about it from a strategic place of how can I come up with the best strategy to take their money, because I guess in the end, isn't that the best revenge?
She says she divided the men who had stereotypes about her into three categories.
One was the flirting chauvinist, and that person was really viewing me in a way that was sexual.
With the guys who were like that, Annie could make nice.
I never did go out on a date with any of them, but you know, it was kind of flirtatious at the table, and I could use that to my advantage.
And then there was the disrespecting chauvinist. Annie says these players thought women weren't creative.
There are strategies that you can use against them. Mainly, you can bluff those people a lot.
And then there's a third kind of guy, perhaps the most reckless.
The angry chauvinist.
This is a guy who would do anything to avoid being beaten by a woman. Annie says you can't bluff an angry chauvinist. You just have to wait.
What I say is until they would impale themselves on your chips.
So I find this very fascinating. It's a very powerful perspective to take. It's to take the tools that the dominant use to sort of oppress and to use them to your advantage. And it's a very empowering posture to have, to think about, okay, yes, there is structural inequality, there's implicit bias, there's stereotypes, they're not fair, the deck is stacked against me, but how can I step back and remove myself from it and use it to my advantage? And again, I think about, especially if you're in a field where there is competition, whether it be sports or sales or even negotiating diplomacy, if you can sort of understand some of these social dynamics that are happening and use them to your advantage, because in a sense what she was saying was reaffirming that this is unconscious bias, this is implicit bias, that people are actually acting without even consciously aware of it. And she had begun to profile the different players, the different male players, and sort of came up with a strategy of how to play them. And at the end, have a competitive advantage over them. So now knowing that she's facing stereotype threat, but she also implements the stereotype tax, how many of you think that she ended up winning the tournament? And how many end up thinking that she lost the tournament? Okay, so now I'm going to bring you up to speed to the basically the final moment of the World Series of Poker, where, and the guy is just classic. I don't know if it'll be in this clip, but basically it's going to show him just the words that he uses, so there's a lot of just beeping out because it was on public radio. And what you see her is just this very, this posture of like, I'm all here, and I'm on top of my game. And basically at the very end, what he does is the final move, he says he's all in, which is very rare because it's sort of basically like the game will be over for both in a sense if he wins, or you know it'll be over if he loses as well.
By the time she got to the Poker Tournament of Champions, Annie had been using psychology to win matches for a long time. So when it got down to the last two players,
90,000 is the bet from Phil Hellmuth.
Annie was ready.
This is all right, you know. I'm just happy to be in the final two. I mean, seriously,
You could argue that this little old me act really did a number on Phil Hellmuth.
Somehow.
Because for the next half a dozen hands,
some way,
he just did not know what to make of Annie.
God dang it all, I should have moved in before the flop.
Annie keeps the charm turned up.
Are you saying you had a good hand, Phil?
I had a pocket pair.
Sorry I couldn't accommodate you.
You gave me the race.
And they go back and forth like this all the way to the final hand.
Annie's got Phil second-guessing every move he makes and every move he doesn't make.
Phil thought Annie was bluffing. In fact, he thought that she'd been bluffing a lot.
I'm all in.
And with that top pair, Phil Hellmuth going all in with his 450,000 chips. Annie Duke put the pressure on Phil when she check-raised him. And now with Phil's all-in call, the pressure is back on Annie.
At this point, it's obvious to both Annie and Phil the other person has a strong hand. The question is, how strong? That's a judgment call, based on probability, instinct, all the psychological undercurrents that have been running through the entire game. But now there's only one question. If Annie thinks that Phil has misjudged her, she knows she should call his bet.
So she's faced with a decision. And, you know, it's just fascinating because this is the moment. This is where she could win the whole tournament and do everything. And what I found interesting, if you watch the whole clip, you just see her in this posture of working the game. And you see Phil just becoming more and more frustrated and just not, like what they said, not knowing what to make of her. And she was using sort of the stereotypes in his disposition to get into his mind to affect his play. And so what she ends up doing is calling his bet.
I call.
And he calls the all-in. And
this
Phil
is Phil.
Sees what he's up against.
If there was any moment that perfectly revealed how much of an outsider Annie was in this situation, it's this next one.
Annie Duke has defeated 9 of the strongest poker players in the world and wins the first ever World Series of Poker Tournament of Champions.
A classic reality television style, cameras follow Phil as he storms away from the table, out a door, just pacing around, talking to himself.
Unbelievable, she won every race for 2 days.
It was the reaction of a man who just got beat.
Show up with King 10.
By someone who wasn't supposed to win.
Oh my god, I won!
And who maybe wasn't even supposed to be at the table. But precisely because Annie Duke knew how stereotypes can be both a threat and an advantage. Well,
you heard Phil, and he was right. Annie was definitely a long shot to win this all, but as the only female at the table, she is now the last man standing.
So I find a lot of what we talk about in this class is sort of how the minority or the less dominant people groups are at a disadvantage. And I believe that they are, but there's also creative ways to use that to your advantage and in thinking strategically about that. Or if you're going into a situation where you know that the deck is stacked against you, thinking deeply about, okay, what are the social dynamics in this room and what are driving people's perceptions and how to address those either head on or in creative alternative ways. And I think this is just a great example of, yes, implicit bias, stereotype threat, and all these things are at work, but they're social constructions. And I think that's a key thing. They are socially constructed. They aren't true in and of themselves. But they're these beliefs and ideas that have sort of been created that aren't based on reality. There might be some elements of truth to them, but they're not definitive. And so if you can begin to realize, okay, a lot of these things that I bump up against are fabrications. They don't really exist. People believe them wholeheartedly, and they make decisions and actions based on them. So, but then, if they're not real, how could I actually use them or manipulate them in ways to my advantage? So it just as you're thinking about it, I think some of the key things that we think about with gender diversity and gender equality, I agree with you that in many ways it's promotions and salary and all those things should be based on performance. I would say that they're not. And my evidence for that is the unequal pay across women in all industries. Another factor of gender diversity is the whole arena of sexual harassment and sexual discrimination, which again is an issue that's imbued with power differentials in a lot of history, which makes it very difficult to disentangle when is someone being discriminated against, when is someone being harassed. And there's a couple of vignettes that give scenarios of sexual harassment or sexual discrimination. And I want to look at them and then let us as a class decide if we were the HR manager for that organization or if we were the owner, how would we proceed with the evidence that's being brought to us?
I'm a fundraiser for a nonprofit school, so I work with private donors to raise money for our scholarship program. One night after an event, I was sitting with my employer and with the host of the event, who was a longtime major donor. We were in his living room talking about the evening successes, and I mentioned some areas I thought I could improve. At that point, the donor suddenly turned to me and asked how old I was. It didn't seem relevant to anything. And then he said, "Being pretty will only get you so far. When do you plan on having children? Because as a 30-year-old, you only have so many years to fulfill your main purpose as a woman." It took me a few seconds to collect my thoughts. I felt threatened, and I knew that if I responded how I wanted to, I could anger a very significant long-term donor. So I said that I was proud of the career I had built thus far. I was a dedicated aunt to my niece and nephew, I'm a professional, and I've traveled the world. Children were not on my agenda. The worst part is, at that point, I looked back at my employer, who just rolled his eyes and looked uncomfortable and took a drink of scotch. The donor just sort of laughed, and he said, "Do not waste your time. Children are the most important thing in life." He then ignored me for the rest of the evening.
You know, as a man, I don't think I ever once had to think about when or whether I wanted to have children. Like, when I'm thinking about career path and career goals, I guarantee you that most every woman in this classroom, that goes across their mind in terms of what career they're going to choose, what vocation, when they would do it, if they're going to go to grad school, and if they go to grad school, or if they're going to go on to even get a PhD, when they're going to do that, and how that would match up with their decision to have kids. For the most of the men in the room, it's just not thought about. And the fact that we don't think about it gives us the idea that women, why would women think about it? Like, we're just not, if it's not something that we're thinking about ever, then it makes sense that we wouldn't realize that maybe women would be thinking about it a lot. And so it affects even career choice in ways that is different, that differentiates men and women. So then you have a scenario like this, where if it was a man in that scenario, the conversation, well, it just wouldn't have happened. It would just be kind of, you know, the person would look like a fool. Whereas in this situation, it's sort of like everyone kind of just doesn't know how to respond. And my question for you all is, what are the options for that woman in that scenario? Like, what are some things that she could have done, whether it be good strategies or bad strategies, or empowering strategies, or acquiescing strategies? What are possible ways that she could have responded?
I mean, I would have either said, "I don't see how that's relevant," or completely ignored that he didn't even say anything and, like, continue talking about the night. Just, like, shut him down by just completely ignoring whatever he just said.
Mm-hmm.
You can't blow up at him because it's just going to escalate the situation, and then you'll probably get fired, unfortunately. But, yeah, I would probably just shut him down and act like he didn't say anything.
So ignore him. What other options? I mean, it's a very tricky situation. He's like a big donor. You don't want to piss him off, and you don't want to be known as the one who got off on a bad foot with this big donor, and now they're not giving anymore. And so even ignoring could be detrimental. You know, and if you think about it, what was this guy's motivation? He was provoking, testing. He wanted a reaction. But you're right. Oftentimes, if you just ignore it, it takes the fun out of it. Any other ideas for strategies or ways that... Yeah, Jeff?
So I could probably ask, when he asked, how old she was, she could, ask back, how old was, your wife when she had your kid, or something, when do you think is a good age to have children? Because he says that he thinks, children are the most important aspect, so...
Mm-hmm.
Ask him, on his opinion of when the proper age is.
Yeah, turn the question back on him. You know what, and this is, I think this takes a lot of skill, but again, it's using this strategic or stereotype tax, is recognize that you are going to be in situations where that's going to come up, whether you're an ethnic minority or gender minority, and it's thinking, okay, why is this person asking this question, and how can I respond in a winsome, creative way that catches him off guard and sort of puts him at an unbalanced posture, and doing it in a way that is with a smile. But you kind of, sort of like how Annie Duke did it in the poker arena, of like getting this person, like, in a sense, if you do what Jeff had mentioned, you're going to get into sort of this debate. In a sense, he's going to win because he's going to be like, well, I can have kids whenever I want to have kids. It doesn't matter. It's not going to affect, you know, I've been highly successful and it doesn't matter. But for you, it matters because, goodness, this would affect your career choice. And so thinking of ways to sort of to get a rise out of this person in power, to strip away his perceived power and just to put him in his place. My other question would be, what if you were the colleague, the male colleague? What are your options? What are possible ways that you could have responded in that situation?
You just, like, step up and say, like, you're out of line. Like, I don't think that's an appropriate thing to talk about right now.
And would you do that?
I would do that, yeah.
It's impressive. I think it'd be incredibly difficult. I mean, like, the safe, conservative thing is just to sort of put your hands in. Okay, let's let this awkward moment pass as fast as it can. Let's not draw any attention. Let's just pretend like it wasn't said. Like, because I don't want to put myself at the center of this fight. Like, this guy is obviously a jerk, but he gives us lots of money. That money's important to us. I don't want to be the one who sent him packing. What are other options for things that you could do? Yeah.
I mean, he could have, like, stood up for her. Kind of, you know, been like, you know, that's why we like her and see so much in her, is because she's professional and, you know, has these goals. Not exactly. I could see why you could just kind of, you know, criticize him for what he was saying. But then again, I would probably just, you know, back up my colleague.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to go on the offensive towards him.
Attacking
so.
Him. So more affirm her and her position and her capacities.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, in general, what the colleague did is typical, and not just in that situation. But again, if we're in social settings and we see incidents happen, our tendency is to do nothing. I mean, there's plenty of studies where they have people out on the street getting mugged or getting beaten, and in different level thresholds of violation, and it's amazing how often people, it's not because they don't think, it's not because they approve of what's happening, but they don't, it's a risk for them to step into those situations and to do something. And so it takes a tremendous character to sort of step up and say, this is wrong, this is inappropriate. And it'll be a challenge for you in the workplace when you see discrimination or harassment taking place. Oftentimes, you won't be the victim of it. You'll just be the observer, the bystander. But you have a responsibility. You have a responsibility in those situations if you want to uphold the values of your organization, or if you believe that men and women should be treated equally, then you have a responsibility. Here's another scenario of an incident of potential sexual harassment.
There was nothing out of the ordinary about this review. He got a middle-of-the-road rating, and I told him, these are things that you do really well. There's some things that you do need to work on. And one of them was that he spent a lot of his work day socializing. Very rarely did I actually find him at his desk. I just made a note of that. A couple months go by, he went to HR and made a claim that I had sexually discriminated, and I had propositioned him and, like, had offered to take him to a strip club in the city. And I'm just kind of like, wow. I don't even know where this is coming from. HR had to go through their process. They went through their entire review. They didn't dismiss it. They instead said, what we found was that you tend to use a lot of coarse language with people. You swear a lot. We're putting you on a performance improvement plan. I was so afraid that I could walk into HR the following Friday and find myself being fired.
So if you were the HR manager, how would you proceed with this, or how would you handle, what are some options for handling a case like this? Mercedes.
I think the first thing would be to talk to the people in the office, because like the lady was saying, if he socializes, then obviously people know that he's constantly sitting at their desk, so I think
mm-hmm.
that that's something that can be eliminated easily.
Mm-hmm. So sort of get a third or fourth party validation of the assessment. But that wasn't his complaint. He wasn't denying that he socializes. They're two separate incidences. He got a review, performance review, and then a couple months later, he accused her of sexual discrimination and harassment. So, I mean, I agree that you want to get third and fourth party validation.
But just like looking forward, just based on that, I would say, I mean, there isn't really any actual proof that it happened. So, I mean, just looking from a more logical standpoint as like an HR person, I would say, there isn't really much evidence here, so your claim is kind of false.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'll look into it, but like, there's no real evidence to back up what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. And what evidence would you need that would...
Just like, I mean, something that's like actually caught on camera of like her doing something inappropriate or saying something inappropriate.
Uh-huh.
In the workplace.
And realistically, what's the likelihood of it being caught on camera in a workplace?
Pretty small.
Uh-huh. And is that a reasonable bar, or what bar should you have? What are you going to say, Jeff?
Yeah, I was just going to say you could probably have like a male manager like review her evaluation afterwards, or just have like another manager.
How you're saying her initial review evaluation of the employee?
Yeah, she. I mean, if he's like saying it's because like she's a woman, like discriminating against him. Like she could, for her next evaluation, she could just have like a guy review it alongside her. So
mm-hmm.
can't really complain.
Yeah, for me, this sort of highlights even the power differentials of here's a woman giving an evaluation to a subordinate, but it's a male. And even in that situation, she's kind of feeling this like, well, how do I give him the bad news that, you know, I don't think he's performing at the capacity he should be performing, and I'm going to criticize his socializing. You know, for anyone giving evaluations, that's a hard thing to do, but then it sort of ups the ante when there's gender differences and when it's the female giving the evaluation to the male. A challenging thing with regard to sexual harassment is this idea of proving it. Just this last week at UC Berkeley, there's a professor, astronomy professor, who he's basically the world-renowned astronomy professor. He's on lists for potentially getting a Nobel laureate, and he's one of the prize jewels of UC Berkeley's faculty. And over a period of years, there's been people submitting claims that he had sexually harassed them in different ways. And things related to, and it's mainly students, grad students and undergrads, who had said that he had inappropriately touched them, he had made very suggestive comments to them. The university just finished a six-month-long investigation into this. And this is the news article that came out last week. It says, after a six-month investigation, the university found that he had violated campus sexual harassment policies between 2001 and 2010, so a period of 9 years. So this wasn't a single incident. This was multiple incidents over a period of time with multiple people filing complaints. Specifically, there are four women that alleged that he had repeatedly engaged in inappropriate physical behavior with students, including unwanted massages, kisses, and groping. So this is the university's response after the six-month investigation. This is where they actually, I mean, they don't have the proof that you're talking about, but they have corroborating testimonies. The university says, we consider this to be a very serious matter, and the university has taken strong action. As a result of the findings, the women were informed that the professor has been given clear expectations concerning his future interactions with students, which he must follow or risk sanctions that could include suspension or dismissal.
How has, like, the last 9 years not been, like, how has he not known for the past 9 years that he was violating campus, like, rules?
Well, and this is why this is blown up in the media. Basically, they're saying that the university is protecting him. I mean, it's just the word, these are quotes, is basically saying that we've given him clear expectations concerning his future interaction with students. And that if he does mess up, he could get suspended or dismissed. Now, I'm a parent, and when I go to my 7-year-old kid and I say, you really shouldn't have stolen that. In fact, let me reiterate to you that it's bad to steal cookies when you don't have permission. And if you steal another cookie in the future, there might be even more severe consequences. So you better not do it. I mean, it's sort of like any parent would know that's bad parenting. Olivia.
So is there no investigation until now throughout the 9 years?
Well, I'll get into sort of what led up to the ultimate investigation. So there were inquiries, but not investigations. There were complaints filed, but no, there was finally a formal investigation. So then one of the university faculty in response said, after all this effort of going through all the, you know, sort of providing as much evidence and proof as possible, finally to get to a place where we, here it is, here's four different students who are going to testify. A lot of their stories overlap and are feeling the same. And so we do everything that you ask us to do. We go through the proper channels. And basically this woman says, I've seen sexual harassers get slapped on the wrist before, but this isn't even a slap on the wrist. So after they've done all the due diligence, gone through all the proper channels, basically nothing happens. And then what an astronomer says from another university, he talks about the implications of this is already a male-dominated field, the field of astronomy, and this sends a signal of, you know, if this field is trying to increase female participation, again, what woman who's sort of following all of this would have an added incentive or feels like they're going to be treated fairly or protected in a potentially hostile environment. It just, again, dissuades and discourages them from going into this field. And what they go on to say, and basically, so they're like, why did the university buckle under this? And so then they retrace sort of what happened over the past, you know, since 2001. Well, the first claims that came out were from a grad student who was talking with other grad students and undergrads and basically hearing these stories, and this woman was like, you've got to tell somebody. And they said, well, you know, this is Professor Marcy. I mean, he's, you know, think of like the president of the university, you know, someone that's just like, they're sort of on this pedestal where, you know, and you're an undergrad. And so they're like, the whole situation was awkward to begin with, and then for me, who am I going to go to explain this to, and it's a very awkward situation. So this grad student went on their behalf and complained, and they said, I'm sorry, we can't take complaints from a not, you know, in anonymity. We need the actual person to come and give the complaint. And so eventually over time, the women went forward, but, you know, imagine sort of, they have to, first of all, identify themselves, like, I am this person, and this is what this very prominent professor did, and I have to make sure that you believe me, because I don't want to sort of, you know, it's his word against my word, and so it's just a very awkward thing, but what it was one person went forward, and that encouraged other women to go forward, and what happened was this sort of ripple effect of other women saying, yeah, it was the same exact thing happened to me. You know, it's these classic scenarios of like they're at an event on campus, and he's like, oh, can I give you a ride home? Which could be perfectly innocent, but if that ride home always entails a proposition or some inappropriate touching or just sexual innuendos, then you see a pattern. And so this whole idea of sexual harassment is very, very complicated. It's very difficult to prove. It's one person's word against another person's word. But if you do have multiple testimonies and all the stories are the same, and they're over a period of years, there's strong evidence. And yet, even if you have good evidence, and even this professor wrote an apology letter. He said, you know, I've become aware that some women felt that some of my actions were not welcomed. I don't agree with all the claims, and I don't, you know, but, you know, he sort of gave some implication that there's some validity to what went on, different interpretations of what went on, but I realize now that they're unwelcomed. But then the university has all this evidence, and still, they turn a blind eye. I mean, I'm shocked by how they responded, especially if they have such a strong, clear policy on what happens in cases of sexual harassment or sexual discrimination, and then to give that type of statement. Well, then the larger community reacted strongly, not just at Berkeley, but around the country. And literally just yesterday, this professor resigned. There are basically calls for the university to fire him, and he, and I don't know the full story, but basically he came in literally just yesterday and said, I resign. And so on one level, there was social pressure. It started with the grad student trying to advocate for the undergrads, and then some of the undergrads stepping up and sort of going public with their story. But even the system, which is supposed to be there to protect them and sort of be an advocate for them, even when the evidence was there, the system still failed them. And so, you know, it's just, when we think about gender discrimination and sexual harassment, it's a very complicated thing, but to ignore it, or to sort of just say, well, let's just pretend that that didn't happen. The victims, the people who are the victims of those situations, are the ones who suffer in silence and sort of get devalued in the process. I don't know what the clear solution is, but recognizing the perspective, recognizing the situation from everyone's position is a valuable component. And I'd say if, when you're in situations like that, of any type, one thing is simply having a safe person within the organization that you can talk to, not necessarily within your department or unit, but someone who knows the field and sort of be able to say, here's something that happened. Is this common? Is this acceptable? Is this out of line? Because a lot of times we play games in our minds saying, you know, one of the women, when she gave her testimony, she's like, I don't know what just happened. And I feel really awkward. And I'm not going to tell anyone, because it's really embarrassing and humiliating. And I don't think it was appropriate, but I'm too embarrassed to tell anybody. And if you don't have a safe person to go to sort of validate or to be a sounding board for what you're experiencing, then you're just sitting there suffering, you know, stuck in your own mind.